Sue Leanne Good, and this is Psych 101. We're here to make psychology understandable, entertaining, enlightening, and informative, with tips for creating a healthier state of mind for you, your family, and friends. Today, my topic is play therapy, and my guest is Mary Ruth Cross. I'd like to tell you a little bit about her background. Mary Ruth is a licensed marriage and family therapist who has extensive training and over 25 years experience in working with traumatized children and their families. She is the director of her San Ramon Children and Family Counseling Center in San Ramon, California. Mary Ruth is adjunct faculty for University of Phoenix in the Masters of Science Counseling degree program. She is also a registered play therapist, supervisor, and the current president for the California Association for Play Therapy. Mary Ruth's current project is being the co-founder of Connecting to Play Therapy, a specialized training program for individuals interested in becoming a registered play therapist. I'd like to welcome Mary Ruth.
Hello.
Hi, Mary Ruth. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Well, you know, this is an interesting subject because a lot of people in the general public don't know what play therapy is for children. Could you give us a little bit of an explanation of that?
Sure. Play therapy is an interesting field because it has many ways of doing it. But play therapy really came out of other theories like, for example, child client-centered therapy, like Carl Rogers did. His work was expanded on to so that we could use it with children, so we could understand children's play and see how they might be developing. Are they on a normal path? Are they not on a normal path? And there are other theories that have taken the idea of play and say, okay, so how do we adapt play in a therapeutic way that can help children? And then later it came, other theorists talked about having family play therapy. So now we use play therapy not just with young children, but with middle school kids and teenagers and families. And I use play therapy with just about every client that comes through the door, regardless of their age.
That's interesting because I would imagine that's a little challenging working with adults and trying to get them to play in your therapy room.
Yes. Yes. And so there's a little adaptation that goes to with encouraging adults to enter into play. But one of the interventions that I use is called Fantre. And so in order to use this intervention, you have to have lots and lots and lots of small toys, miniatures that represent anything in life that you could imagine, from a little telephone to superheroes to trees and plants to animals and fantasy figures and figures that look just like real people. So the way a sand tray toys are set up, as in any play therapy room, the toys are set up in such a way that it looks inviting and engaging. So it's not uncommon for adults who walk into my office to have the first thing be, wow, you have a lot of toys, and maybe I could play with them. Mm-hmm. Well, right then and there, I know I've got somebody who's open to the idea of expanding how play might be helpful to them. So with that person, it's an easier journey to introduce play interventions to them rather than somebody who's come here, you know, an adult, for example, that's come to, I've got to deal with my relationship issues. Okay, well, we can talk about that, but also there are playful things that we can introduce to help amplify a metaphor that might be going on between the couple or for the individual in a relationship. So there's lots of different ways that we can pull that in.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify what sand play is, it's like a miniaturized sandbox that is up on stilts. And and the figurines you're talking about are like, think about what the like little army men are, you know, the little green ones on their stands, but much more extensive than that. So The nice thing about play therapy with any kind of age group is that it kind of digs into the subconscious, especially if it's an intimidating experience for a person to be coming into doing therapy.
Right. Yeah, and with the Santre, there's Santre and Santplay, two different modalities using the Santre, which is a specific size, and you have all these miniatures. But having whether it's an adult or a child, you still have to work on that first therapeutic task, which is developing a therapeutic alliance, developing rapport. And in my way of thinking about psychotherapy, it's also about creating safe, sacred space so that they can get to those unconscious conflicts that they have within themselves. For children, we see that unconscious material coming out in their behavior. And usually with children, it's their behavior that's bothering an adult, is why they usually come into treatment. They don't usually say, "Hey, Mom, I think I'd like to have therapy today."
Right.
Thanks.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I'm sure that's a rare occurrence.
It is a very rare occurrence. Although it can happen when a child has a family environment where maybe Mom has had her own therapy or Dad has done some therapy, and the child just says, "I just need somebody to talk to." And we find that with middle school students and teenagers, but that's actually not so uncommon. So being able to create this safe, sacred space through the relationship with the therapist, but also the environment of the playroom. It has to be safe, engaging, interesting, inviting. All of those things make a difference on how well somebody's going to be open to playing.
Right.
Not everybody is open to playing. And we think we are. We think, "Oh, yes, I'm a very playful person." Well, what would you do with three scarves and a strange hat? Could you play with that? Can you do some role play? And that's when people go, "Oh, I would never dress up." Well, that's a form of play. So we might not necessarily start with that, but we might encourage them to be able to use the scarf to make a cape you'd use in a bullfight, or maybe you'd have it your superhero cape or something. So using the imagination to step into that just a little bit deeper.
Right. And like in my therapy room, too, I have different things that they can choose from, because not everybody wants to be doing artwork. Some people want to be doing puppets or, you know, so it's good to have a variety of things that kind of speak to people, because, you know, therapy can be an intimidating process. So creating that safety, especially for the little ones, is really important.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And like you were saying, the variety of the different things. I have puppets, and not just one or two. I have many puppets, because some children are going to want to use a puppet that looks like a person. Others will want one that looks like an animal. But you can also have, I have this wonderful puppet. His name is Mr. Wiz. And he's just this strange-looking furry thing. And sometimes it's easier to project ourselves onto something that's less defined than more defined. So having a lot of variety is very important.
Right, and then sometimes you can see some real interesting parts of a personality coming out during puppet play, because like you said, they'll put parts of their personality onto the object and then let that object speak for what they truly want to say, but maybe afraid to say or have been coached into not saying.
Yes, absolutely. It's easier for the puppet to say, "I'm scared, I'm worried," than for a child to say that out loud sometimes.
Right, because sometimes they've been manipulated into not saying those words or not speaking their truth. So therefore, the puppet can do it for them safely.
And or maybe the child just comes from a family system where talking about things directly isn't really part of their culture. Well, we as play therapists, we need to be sure that we are respecting each child's culture so that we can understand their play in as balanced a perspective as possible. If you step away from looking at culture and diversity issues, you may over-pathologize a child's behavior unnecessarily.
Right. And then you do have to look into it in a cultural context, because there are certain cultures that have been taught that you can speak to a family member, but it's not so good to be talking to a stranger. And when they are coming in to see us, we are strangers at first until we build up the relationship.
Yes.
So it takes time.
Yes, it does take time. And some children can feel that connection easier than other children. And so we have to be sure that we are real clear on the child's culture. And then can we bring, for example, if it's a culture where you speak to the elder first, that is a little counterintuitive to the way we do psychotherapy in the United States, where we're trying to establish an individual relationship with a child. And in California, where I'm located, our confidentiality laws are very strict, and there's a lot of things that we cannot tell a parent. So if we aren't able to understand the person's culture, they may be very offended just by the way we normally do things. So we have to be really careful in a treatment room to be sure we're addressing that appropriately.
Right. And then in the state of California, the children also have a right to confidentiality.
Just as much as an adult. And in fact, I was on a case recently, kind of hit home that the parents cannot waive that right to confidentiality. If there's a legal case going on, they have to ask that an attorney be appointed to the child to determine if there should be a release of information. It's pretty strict here. I'm not sure what it's like in other states or other countries, but we got to be pretty careful about that.
Right, and then that can definitely complicate the whole process of family therapy right there, because there's, let's face it, there's certain parents that really want to know exactly what's going on with their children. You know,
yeah.
But in the therapy room, it's hard for parents to understand that your child needs to have a safe place to be able to just tell their secrets if they need to tell their secrets. And if they want, if they want me to tell mom or dad, they need to sit there and say, you can tell my mom and dad this or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yes. And so one of the ways that I work that is I talk in the very beginning of treatment, I really talk about confidentiality and privacy, because that does help the child trust the therapist better. But one of the things that I try and do is at the end of a session, I'll say to the child, without the parent present, is there anything that you want to share with mom or dad about what we did today? And if the child says yes, then great, bring mom and dad in and we can talk about a couple of things. If the child says no, then the answer is no.
Right.
And we don't share anything. But one of the things that I have found helpful is I'll say, we were talking about a particular subject, and I'm thinking, your mom might really want to know that. Is that possible for you to tell her that? And if the answer is no, then depending upon what the issue is, I might say, is it possible that I could tell her? Would that be okay with you? And so if you have the child's permission for that, that works really well. But part of what kids do sometimes developmentally is they will protect their parents unconsciously from knowing all of their feelings. And it's like maybe they think that mom or dad can't handle it, particularly if it's, a high stress or trauma sort of a situation. Oh, mom and dad are so overwhelmed, I can't tell them about my feelings. So we have to keep those kinds of things in consideration too when we're working with kids in play therapy.
And what do you do with children who have been traumatized? That's got to be pretty stressful for both parties involved. And then you have the confidentiality, and then you have all the feelings coming up from the child. Can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Sure. Well, in any kind of trauma work, you're going to spend a lot of time, more so than with children who have not been traumatized, just creating safe space and making sure that you have a very strong therapeutic alliance. And because what happens with children, particularly like in cases of sexual abuse, for example, there could be an awful lot of shame that's going on for them. And you have to be careful that you don't rush the process and that you allow the child to learn to moderate their feelings as you develop the relationship. So it's not uncommon for kids to maybe do a traumatized children to do a sand tray, and then what they want to do is play a board game that has no emotional connection whatsoever. Or they may want to play catch. Or they may, I work in an area where there's a little wooded area, and sometimes the kids will say, can we just go for a walk? So we'll go downstairs and walk for a little while. That's their way of moderating what's coming up for them. So when we think of play therapy, it's not just the things we do in the office. It also is about developing a playful approach to anything that the children bring into the office with them. Maybe they're tired. Maybe they're hungry. Particularly, you know, we see kids a lot of after school, and so I encourage parents to give them a snack in the car on the way to the office if they're coming right after school, because I want the child to, you know, feel pretty good as best they can anyway about coming to the office. So with traumatized kids, that's the first thing, is this safe, sacred space. Go slowly. Watch very carefully how they're working through it. You also have to be able to do your own work and handle any kind of play that they may do that feels disturbing. Mm-hmm. With trauma play, it's usually what you see is that the child would do the same play over and over without resolution. And when that happens, you have to be very careful and mindful of how to intervene. You don't want to stop it too soon because the child may need this sort of repetition compulsion for a few times, but if it keeps going on, it actually is keeping the child stuck in their trauma and not allowing them to move on. So some of the interventions for trauma at that level are about being very gently trying to introduce a new theme for the child. For example, if the child was doing some aggressive play with puppets and it was the same play over and over again, but the person always died or the puppet, something bad always happened to a puppet, I might look at, grab one of the other puppets and make an intervention like, oh, I'm so sad that you're doing whatever the behavior is again. I really wish I could help. And then watch what the child does with that by introducing somebody who's caring and responding in a new way to whatever is happening with the puppet. So it does take some more advanced training in trauma to understand any kind of physiological responses the child may be having that are very subtle. You know, it's called diffuse physiological arousal, and you can have another word for it would be flooding. So we have to make sure that we have activities and interventions that allow for some emotional expression without it making things worse for the child through flooding.
Okay, so in other words, flooding is having too much of an emotional expression without control behind it. Is that correct?
Yes, that's a really good way to put that, yeah.
Yeah, and with traumatized children, that is the whole situation sometimes is just that loss of control is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the loss of control, and also the feelings have happened so fast, they don't really know what they feel. For example, I was working with a little boy who was age 4 at the time of treatment started, and he was in a very bad car accident. His mother and grandmother and little sister were in the car, and they were on the way to the zoo. And after the accident happened, he had to stay in the car until the fire department and the paramedics came. He and his family were not injured, but it was a pretty severe car accident, and he was the last child pulled from the car by the paramedic. And he was having just all kinds of anxiety and fear about driving in the car. He's a very, very bright little boy, and he would say, "Oh, Dad, I'm not going to drive in the car. We're not going to the zoo, are we, Dad? Are we, Dad? You're going too fast, Dad." So no matter where they were going or what they were doing, his anxiety was just getting more and more out of control. So when I started treatment with him, he had some very aggressive behaviors, you know, lots of, like, I have, we do sword fighting with pool noodles, you know, those styrofoam floaty things. And so he would do that, and he was very, just very angry about it. And then one day in session, he was using one of the dolls that I have in the office, and he did this whole rescue scene where he and his father was doing some filial therapy with him at the time, and his dad was interacting with them, and they had this tragedy, this really bad thing that happened, and then he went and he grabbed the baby and says, "I have to save the baby." And then that was the first time that he had introduced that theme. He'd done the other type of play many times before, but now he was resolving it. And it was through that play I could see that he was telling himself that he should have kept his little sister safe. And it was an amazing thing. You think, wow, he's only four. Is he really thinking this way? The rest of his play showed us that that's exactly what he was thinking. And once we were able to realize that and put it out into the room clearly and verbally, he started to improve immensely after that. He just was not anxious. He could then ride in the car. And so we had to get to this really deep peace, that thing that had happened inside of him. But for him, the emotions were happening so fast that all he could feel was anxious. Once we were able to play all of that out, it really was very healing for him.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. And what a gift for him to have therapy with you, to be able to process that out and not carry that on for the rest of his life. And then it ends up turning into a phobia down the road. Because wouldn't you say that happens a lot with trauma that is not processed out? It turns into different personality quirks or phobias or whatever is going to end up happening down the road, that just because of being stuck in that trauma story.
Yeah, and I really admire parents who are willing to put their children into play therapy when they're young to work through this, whether it's trauma or any other kind of issue that may be present for them. Because I think we're asking a lot of parents to trust us, and then when we can't tell them things, they have to trust us even more that their child is getting better. But you're absolutely right. If we don't intervene in the younger years, what is not resolved then will continue to be a problem later in life. And that's one of the most important things I think we do as play therapists, is that we are really trying to bring mental health into the person's entire life.
Exactly.
Good mental health.
Right, exactly. How would you say that play therapy differs from just doing regular talk therapy?
Well, first of all, it's a lot more fun.
Yes.
You know what? If it's not fun, it isn't play, right?
Right.
So, one of the biggest things is I think in our words, we can really hide. And there, particularly if you have a client who is reluctant to go to these deeper places in themselves, play therapy circumvents a lot of that, because it isn't the front part of your brain that's working. It's the back end, the unconscious part, and you can't help but project yourself into whatever play activity you're doing. Your true self shows up. And that's one of the beauties of doing play therapy, is we're getting to the truth of who you are and what you're feeling.
So what do you do with clients who are just stuck and they're resistant and they're stubborn and they don't want to do any play? What do you do then?
Well, we have teenagers that are like that. And Dr. Eliana Gill said one time in a workshop that I attended, and she's one of the foremost authorities on child abuse recovery in the nation, maybe even in the world, if I dare say that. But she said she doesn't use the word resistance because that sounds like a conscious act. What she talks about is reluctance. And she said, of course people are going to be reluctant to look at their shadow side or look at the parts that hurt. So when we think about it, we're asking people when they come into therapy, whether it's play therapy or talk therapy modalities, we're saying, tell me, be vulnerable. Tell me what you think. Tell me what you feel. And I will be non-judgmental and trust that I'll be non-judgmental. When in fact, many of our clients don't come from environments like that. So we're asking them to have a tremendous amount of courage. And so the first thing that you work on isn't the play, it's the relationship. And we have to remember that any therapy, whether it is based in cognitive behavioral therapy or child-centered or gestalt or psychodynamic or any of them, it's first and foremost a relationship. And if you don't have a relationship that allows for trust and safety, you're not going to have very effective therapy.
Right. So almost in a way then, it kind of doesn't make any difference which technique that you use. It's just so that you start the relationship off, at least at the beginning, until you can see the client a few times. And then come up with a plan together and come up with goals and see where that takes you.
Right. There are children that come in to my office, and adults too, with great curiosity to begin with. For those children, they may jump right in and use the sand tray, and they may do some storytelling and very quickly show me a lot of their unconscious thoughts and feelings. And then there are other kids that come in where they don't seem to have that level of curiosity. So I may say to them things like, well, who's your best friend? What is your favorite thing to do at school? What's your least favorite thing to do at school? Can you draw me a picture of something happening at school? And that way you do safe things. In play therapy, we have different levels of types of play. And when children start treatment, they usually do safe play that doesn't share a whole lot of who they are. But then as they feel safe and trusting of the therapist and the therapy process, they go into what we call unsafe play. And unsafe play is where it's unsafe to them. It's not life-threatening, but emotionally they're showing more and more of themselves. And so there are play activities that I can do with a child who is feeling reluctant to go to unsafe play. So I might suggest, would you like to do a sand tray today? Well, I don't know. Well, you get to decide. And the language we use is, you can do almost anything you want here. If there's something you can't do, I'll let you know. Mm-hmm. And with children and adolescents that remain reluctant, then what we have to do is we really have to look at, well, what's going on in the system, the family system, that is making them hold so tightly to something that's not working. And I might even say to an adolescent, you know, wow, you know, I don't mean to get all Dr. Phil on you, but is that working for you?
Yeah.
So use a little bit of humor to help them see that, and it's a way of saying, I see you're hurting. I hear you don't want to change this. I get that. But is it really working for you?
Because right.
I can help you with that if you let me.
Right. But sometimes you have to look at that resistance as that it serves a purpose, and it's served a purpose for a really long time. And just to pick away at those layers and to really see what is underneath them is an incredible time. But it's just, it's a process. And sometimes, would you agree that sometimes with children, it takes that process takes a little bit longer?
It depends on the child. In all honesty, I think that the child that doesn't have a couple of things. One, doesn't have a home environment where it's okay to talk about thoughts and feelings freely. That child, along with maybe a child who is more introverted and so doesn't feel the need to externalize their internal process, those kinds of kids are going to take longer to process things in a way that we would want them to externalize. And there again, we go back to that piece we were talking about of really seeing the uniqueness of the child and trying to step into their world, okay? So if this is a shy, quiet child, I'm going to try not to come off as bombastic and loud and big, but really to try and match them. And I think that's one of the keys to helping a child process thoughts and feelings. You're matching them, the therapist matches them as much as possible, because then there's going to be resonance and they're going to want to process things more smoothly.
Right. I think the matching is important with whatever clients we're working with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Because
regardless if it is an adult or a child or even in play therapy or no play therapy, matching them and tuning in is very important.
Right, because you just don't want to come off as being the expert and mm-hmm. and being intimidating, especially with kids. You just don't want to come off as being, well, I'm another parent or I'm another teacher or whatever authority mm-hmm. figures they're having problems with. You just don't want to be another one of them.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, children see right through people who are not real, and they are not always able to articulate it depending upon their developmental level, but they absolutely will see through somebody who is just trying to get one over them on them or be officious or tell them what to do, give unsolicited advice. Particularly with teenagers, it's very disrespectful. And they aren't going to respect the person who isn't real. And the other thing that I see in children, and blows parents of very young children away when I say this, but kids don't miss a thing. They are very observant. And parents will say, you know, my child doesn't know that we're having any kind of marital discord. And I often say, want to bet?
Yeah, they're acting out on it.
Yeah.
Look again. Exactly.
Yeah.
I know they don't have that ability to sit there and try to say, well, is this wrong or is this right? Or is this the truth or is this a lie? They just look at you. You can tell it in their faces when mm-hmm. they know that you're lying to them or just trying to be somebody that you're not. And you're right. They don't appreciate it.
Right. And so when you were asking a little while ago about what do you do with a really resistant client? Well, first and foremost, you're real and you label it. Yeah, you don't want to be here. I understand that. I don't think I'd want to be here either if I were you. Problem is, without being here, this problem is just going to stay exactly where it is.
Yeah,
and I've had kids who have been court ordered to treatment. And so I will also add, bummer of it is, kiddo, you are required to be here. So we can sit here and stare at each other if you like. I'm good at that. Or, you know, I've got a room full of toys. Which choice would you like to make?
Yeah, exactly.
So really putting it on them, you know.
Right, don't waste 50 minutes, right? Just staring at each other.
and that's an interesting idea. Is it really a waste of 50 minutes if it's the realest thing that child has done all day? Is stare at somebody and allowed to have that level of control? There's a lot of real subtleties to psychotherapy that actually are beautiful little gems like that. Is it really bad if the child is allowed to have that level of control? I don't know. Depends upon the case, but I would be open to that as an alternative experience.
I like that. I just want to pause for just a second. I want to let the listeners know, if you would like to listen to this program again or you have to cut it short for whatever reason, you can always go to iTunes and download this program at any time. All you have to do is type in Psych 1-on-1, and that's P-S-Y-C-H, the number 1, O-N, and another number 1. Now, Mary Ruth, I wanted to ask you, is there ever a time that play therapy doesn't work?
That's an interesting question. And in fact, years ago, I took a workshop because I was intrigued by that. It's like, oh, when doesn't it work? Well, it was kind of supposed to be a joke because play therapy always works. And one of the keys to remember, though, and is recognize that just because there's resistance or there isn't as much growth as the therapist thought there should be does not mean it didn't work. So play therapy, as is any therapy, is contingent upon one really important thing, and that is that the relationship for the child and the therapist is the right fit. If it's not the right fit for whatever reason, then it's going to limit how successful the therapy can be. So, for example, I talk about this with the parents that come for their, you know, initial intake appointment. I ask them, I want you to be thinking, is Mary Ruth listening? Did she get the point? Did she have, am I coming across in a way that makes you feel supported, listened to, and understood? And at the end of that session, I check in with them and say, how was it to talk to me today? And if there's any reluctance or resistance or anything that's coming up, then we can deal with it at that point. But the same is true for the sessions with the children. It has to feel like it's the right fit. Otherwise, it isn't going to work. So play therapy in and of itself works. If it's not the right fit between the therapist and the client, it limits its ability to be successful.
Right. And then the whole thing is, too, and you're right. I highly agree with you with the right fit. That is for anybody that goes into doing therapy, because sometimes we just, you know, client and therapist don't mesh, and that's okay because there's other therapists out there. And I have talked to I don't know how many people that ended up having a bad therapy session, and then they just made the decision for the rest of their lives, oh, I don't want to go to therapy because that doesn't work. And, you know, right. I went to it once, and I think I end up being more screwed up than what I was when I went in. And, you know, I've heard all the different arguments about going to therapy. But, you know, to realize that you're right, that you have to have the right fit. There's a lot of different therapists out there. And as I've told my listeners so many times, you know, it's wonderful that we have the internet access now to different therapists. You can sit there and you can do research on them. You can mm-hmm. call them up. Some of the therapists are open to talking to you for a minute or two, and you can kind of get a sense of whether or not it's going to work. You know, it's an intuitive thing. And you've got that right to. And as a consumer, you have the right to go and get decent mental health no matter what age you're at. And sometimes, I mean, what's the youngest client that you've ended up working with?
I think he was about 3 years old, I think. Yeah, so ask me who the oldest client is.
Okay, how old is the oldest one?
83.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it was really a remarkable couples therapy that I did with this elderly couple, and we did some family play therapy interventions. It turned out beautifully. One of my favorite play therapy interventions to do is what's called the family play genogram. And so, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the genogram, but you draw out it's a family map. So of the current generation, the one behind, and the if there are any children that they're added into this. So it's just a way to map out families and family relationships on a multi-generational level. And so the play part of it is that we ask, draw it out on a very large piece of paper, and then you ask the each member in the family to pick one of the sand tray miniatures or toys to that represent each person on the genogram. And so it becomes this visual picture of what the how each person is experienced in the family. So I did this with a family where there were two teenage boys, and their mother and father had been killed or died somehow, and they were now living with their maternal uncle and his wife. And there was a lot of discord with the younger boy, the younger teen, and a lot of power struggles between the boy and his uncle, and it seemed like the uncle was getting angry over things that many people might not be angry about. So when we did the family play genogram, the uncle chose like a very vicious tiger with its mouth snarling and to represent this boy, and the boy took he represented himself as an archer, so this strong figure with a bow and arrow pointed at the figure of the uncle. And so it became this wonderful image that they could see. The boy was able to say, "I feel threatened by you." And the uncle could now see, "Oh, wow, you feel threatened by me. I see that." Now, so your responses are about being guarded, and your responses are about protecting yourself. And that was a monumental moment in the family play therapy, that when the uncle finally got that some of his behaviors were making this teenage boy behave the way he was. It was wonderful. It was absolutely a magical moment. That's what I love about play therapy, is there are magical moments like that that you go, I don't know that we would have gotten to just by talking about it.
Right, because sometimes just talking can be it can be so constricting sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we don't have the language for really deep feelings.
Yes.
Even as adults, right. Because we're not trained in this society to be talking about feelings, you know, especially men still. I mean, for as much progress as men have made on the emotional front, there's still so many men that I know that have a very difficult time getting in touch with feelings and putting a name to them. So mm-hmm. I think through being able to express it in an artistic way, in whatever way that they express art, it doesn't have to be painting or drawing. It could be, mm-hmm. you know, whatever ways that they want to, you know, just be able to use their hands and get those emotions to process out.
Yeah, I would agree with you that, and I think that's another cultural piece we have to be sensitive to as well.
Exactly. Do you ever use computers in your therapy room?
I do. I use them quite a bit. I have an iPad, and so I use that for a couple of things. One is, with the parents and child's permission, I make little videos of their sessions. For example, a little boy was doing a puppet play, and he'd done this puppet play a couple of times in a row. So now it was feeling like it was taking on a little more importance than just having done it once. So I asked him if it would be okay if we recorded the puppet show, and also they kids like to make movies, and they like to have their picture taken or the picture of their work taken. So I use my iPhone or my iPad for those sorts of things. But it also becomes, and again, you have to have the child's permission, but it becomes a wonderful tool to show the parent at the end of a session what the child has done, and then you can talk about it, and the child can see from the other side what they created. And it's not uncommon for kids to go to, first of all, be very proud of what they created, but also to get some insight into some deeper meanings for it. And it's a wonderful way to help parents see what their child is doing in therapy so that they feel like they have some information without, you know, breaching that confidentiality piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another way of putting, bringing the art into it, is making it a little bit of a movie. And then it makes it more real for the child, I would imagine, once they sit there and they can play it back. Because once they're doing the acting, they're in the moment. That's
exactly right.
Yeah, they're almost disconnected from it in a way, because they're in the moment. That's it. So when you sit there and film them on that, that's, you know, makes another piece of the puzzle.
Right. They are now stepping out of action, and they are the observer. And to be the observer to their own life, it's very powerful. The other way that I use iPads, and actually I have a laptop too, so before I got my iPad, I used my laptop, and that is with teenagers, is if they feel comfortable and can say, can you show me your Facebook page, the MySpace page, or can you find three YouTube videos that say something about you? And that is very revealing. So that you can you're just stepping into that teenager's world a little bit more. Computers and electronics technology is so much a part of children and teens' lives. I think we as therapists really need to be sure we're staying on top of that and being involved with it ourselves.
Yeah, I agree, definitely, because it's, you know, it's a different way of thinking. It's coming up within the computer age, you know, for the last, you know, well, starting with the 20 and 30 something year olds, and you know, it wires the brain differently than if you're past that age group. It made a huge difference on developmental, you know, issues and everything else. It's just a way different way of thinking, and I think that's brilliant that you bring in, you know, Facebook and YouTube and anything else that they're into, because that's definitely a way of expressing themselves on a daily basis. A lot of times, when they're at home, they shut that world off to their parents, period, unless their parents are monitoring that kind of activity, which some parents do, but I would imagine that most parents don't.
That's, you know, the research that my colleague Leslie Baker and I have done is that, unfortunately, the majority of parents don't monitor their children. And I don't really understand that. It's like you're giving them a loaded weapon, and you can't turn on the television without the news, without seeing some violence against children, whether it is kidnapping or abuse, or we locally here in Northern California have had a couple of incidences in the last few days where children have been stabbed. And so part of it is, what role does media play in that? But if you have a child who's online freely without any supervision about that, and they're seeing some of this, the violent messages, and the certainly there are predators on the internet, we all know about that, why wouldn't you want to protect your child from that?
Exactly.
Not the least of which then is becomes these social media, where there's the potential for being bullied and getting involved with predators unknowingly. So I can't advocate enough the importance for monitoring your children online. It's really important.
Right, exactly. And that's another show I'd like to do with you, is on bullying, because I know I had listened to one of your discussions before down in Orange in Southern California, about the bullying. Yes, definitely.
The Southern California Regional Play Therapy Conference. Yeah, that was really good. Yeah, and people are hungry for it. And when you have, if you think about it like this, when you have the national government running a symposium on bullying for the last several years, they do this annually, and different aspects of bullying, it's a national crisis.
It is, and it's so different now because of the cyberbullying. That changes the whole field right there. It's not like it's not like it's just on the schoolyard or it's after school. Now it's, you know, you put bad words out there, bad messages on Facebook, and you know, the whole, you know, hundreds of students know the next day if they're on Facebook. That's a huge problem.
Yeah, and you know, whether it's bullying or other, which can and often is traumatizing, play therapy really can play a wonderful healing role in that. Some of the interventions we encourage are about integrating psychodrama and role play with sand tray and expressive art. And I think that's one of the beauties of play therapy is you can integrate various interventions without losing your sound base for the theory of why you do what you do as a play therapist. And I just think that's a really valuable part of what we do.
Right, and then we incorporate fun into it, which is very helpful.
Yeah, I love it. I had a mom say, you know, my child likes to come to you because it's fun. I thought, is that bad? So your child is really struggling, and this particular child is really struggling with OCD. And for an hour a day, when he comes to see me, he is relaxed and he's having fun learning how to manage his OCD. That's not a bad thing. But, sometimes maybe parents get a little bit jealous. How can you have fun with Mary Ruth or whatever therapist, and it's not so fun for me at home? And so then you have to really work with the parents and make sure that they feel supported and taken care of somewhat by the play therapist.
Right, and then sometimes it's more work actually working with the parents than it is the children, because a lot of times that's where the problems and the issues are stemming from, is from the parents or parents. So,
right, their own stuff gets in the way.
Right, and talk about fun. This has been fun. If listeners would like to contact you, where can they get in touch with you?
My website is mrcrossmst.com. Also, my email is maryruth@mrcrossmft.com. Or my voicemail. I'd be happy to talk to somebody on the phone. 925-600-4818.
Great. And the spelling across is CROSS, in case I didn't come up. Yeah.
I know, it's hard to understand sometimes.
Right. Thank you. So, yeah. So, how would you like to wrap this up? What is one of the most important things that you would like to know, have people know about play therapy and the importance of it?
Well, I can't advocate enough for getting advanced training in play therapy. I think that it is an ethical issue if you're going to be working with children and you don't do play therapy with them. I'm wondering, what are you really doing? Because talk therapy is not completely effective for children. And so the Association for Play Therapy is a fabulous organization that promotes the use of play therapy and offers all kinds of wonderful training. In fact, their national conference is in Palm Springs this year. So those of you in California or anywhere, it's going to be a great training. And the leaders in the field of play therapy come to this to teach about various aspects of play therapy. So getting sufficient training and, you know, think about becoming a registered play therapist. It gives you credentials and credibility in the work you would do with children and families. So the program to become a registered play therapist has some things you got to do, but it's all achievable and it's fun. My experience with the Association for Play Therapy and as the president for the California branch of the Association for Play Therapy is I'm in a place with professionals, whether they're students or interns, clinicians, I'm in a place where I'm wanted. And I've had other people say that as well, that you're not with your competition and you don't have to put your guard up. No, you're with people who want to do what you want to do, and that is use play therapy to create healing in the world.
Exactly.
And I know that sounds a little grandiose, but it's really true. Play therapy changes lives, and the phrase I like to use is play therapy makes the world a difference.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Mary Ruth Cross.
Oh, you are welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you so much, listeners, for joining us. This is Julie Ann Good with Psych 1-on-1.